All right, so our numbers are strengthened. The choir is back, which is great. And I've been meaning to do this for a while. I wanted to show you guys kind of the tools that I've been using because I thought some of you might be interested in that. I'll start with this commentary. This blue one is by a guy named James Edwards. It's called The Gospel According to Mark. It's in the Pillar New Testament Commentary. In some ways, I think it's been my favorite of the two because it's really readable. And one of the things you learn when you start working with commentaries is that they all have different strengths. And so when you're dealing with a book like Mark, nobody has a handle on it all. And you'll find that scholars have different things they focus on. And sometimes the best scholars are interested in things that have nothing to do with just understanding the gospel and applying it. And this guy has a good mix of taking on tough questions, but also being readable and useful for someone teaching a Sunday school class. This one is by R.T. France. It's in the New International Greek Testament Commentary. So the strength of it is that in comparison to this one, he will talk more about Greek terms and what they mean and why they're significant in a particular passage. But the way it's organized is less readable, so it's less user-friendly. So I've been kind of pinging back and forth between the two of these, and one of them will be more helpful on one issue than another. And you can find all this sort of stuff on Amazon now. And so one of the things, if you're ever teaching a class that I think is really useful, is go to Amazon, plug in the book or topic that you're teaching, and you can see all sorts of different books, and you can read reviews of them. And people will talk about, well, why they thought their, you know, one was helpful and one wasn't. So that's been a really useful thing for me. Any questions about that before we move on? All right, so to catch everyone up, today's week 7. Last week, or 2 weeks ago, we studied parables about the kingdom. Now Mark is going to abruptly shift today to some miracle accounts. And, you know, throughout the gospel, he's been showing Jesus doing many different types of supernatural miracles. And so the question to ask is, well, why are we going back into miracles? And I think today we're going to see each of these accounts is more detailed than anything he's done so far. And we're going to finally see people get past the point of just being amazed that a miracle has occurred in front of them and beginning to wrestle with the question, what does it say about Jesus? And we're going to see people trying to figure out, well, how are we going to categorize Jesus? You know, what does it mean that he's doing these miracles? And what should we think about Jesus? Okay? And I think we're going to see part of their struggle is that the obvious categories that would have been familiar to them, like prophet, rabbi, rebel, Messiah, none of them neatly fit Jesus. And so we're going to see a lot of people confused and struggling to figure out what to do with Jesus. So let's pick up in Mark 4. So this is starting after the account of the parables, and the NIV has that day when evening came. So someday, right after Jesus has done teaching parables by the lake, it's getting dark, and he said to his disciples, "Let us go over to the other side." So Jesus' ministry is generally based in Galilee, which is to the west of the lake. Now he's talking about heading east. Leaving the crowd behind, they took him along just as he was in the boat. And some of your translations may have something a little different there, but the implication seems to be it's the end of a long, long day of ministry, and Jesus kind of says, just let's get out of here. And they're so anxious to get out of there because they're spent after a long day of ministry, they just head right out. So some commentators say you could translate that as Jesus doesn't even get bothered to get out of the boat that he's been teaching in. They just turn around and get out. So the picture is kind of Jesus and his disciples being utterly spent by this long day of ministry. And perhaps, you know, they're headed to the other side to get away for a little while. And we're told there were also other boats with him. And so this may be an instance where it's not just the 12 with him, but part of the larger group of disciples. What we know about the boats that they might have been in sounds like a lot of the knowledge comes from some shipwrecks they found in the Sea of Galilee that date back to close to that time. And one example of a boat they found was bigger than you might think. It was 26 feet long, had decking in the front and the back. It's a wide boat, but not tall. So they say the sides of the boat were only 4.5 feet tall. So if you can imagine that, kind of makes sense if you're going to be fishing with nets, and it would make it convenient to like haul fish into the boat. But it's not the kind of boat you'd want to be in a storm that was going to have waves, because it would be easy for water to wash in the boat. But that kind of fits what we're going to see in the story, which implies the boat they're in has a deck or some area that Jesus can actually go back to and go to sleep in. Okay? We're told a furious squall came up in the NIV. Does anyone have something different than a furious squall? Great storm, great windstorm. So the thing I really like about the ESV translation, which she said had great windstorm, is the word great is going to recur through this story. And if you repeat that, you can catch some of the connections in a way that translating it as furious doesn't. So a great storm comes, all right? And people also say this is not an unusual thing to happen on the Sea of Galilee. And part of the reason for that is it's a sea surrounded by mountains. So there's kind of a precipitous drop from the mountaintops down to the surface of the lake, and it creates the possibility for sudden storms to occur because you've got these weird air currents, all right? So a great storm comes up, and the waves broke over the boat so that it was nearly swamped. But Jesus was in the stern, sleeping on a cushion. The disciples woke him and said to him, "Teacher, don't you care if we drown?" And so remember, at least four of these guys are professional fishermen who would have been on the lake all the time. So they aren't the kind of guys that are going to panic over nothing. And so for them to be so emotional that they say to Jesus, "Don't you care if we're going to drown?" tells you this is a very serious storm. The boat's in serious trouble. And this is classic Mark. He doesn't tell us we were panicked, we were freaked out. He just tells you what they said, and you have to hear the emotion in what they say and kind of figure out the situation. "Teacher, don't you care if we're going to drown?" All right? It's a serious situation. And what happens? Jesus got up, rebuked the wind, and said to the waves, "Quiet, be still." Then the wind died down and it was completely calm. And the language that's used is sort of the same language a person would use with a rambunctious dog. It's almost like Jesus gets up and says, stay. Or you could translate it as Jesus stood up, looked at the wind, and said, shut up. And the wind did. And then we're told in the Greek, and there was a great calm. So we went from a great storm to a great calm like that. All right? And then Jesus challenges his disciples, why are you so afraid? Do you still have no faith? So Jesus isn't afraid to challenge people. And then we're told in the Greek, a great fear came over them. And this is interesting. So they go from being scared of the storm and thinking they're about to die to then being scared of what Jesus is. And so, I mean, we're talking about a real emotional roller coaster in this episode. They were terrified and asked each other, who is this? Even the wind and the waves obey him. Okay? So, backing up, what's going on here? This is another demonstration of authority. Mark is very big on the concept of authority. And here we're seeing that Jesus has delegated authority from God even over the forces of nature. This is a really big deal to us, but also to first century Jews, in part because if you read the Old Testament, one of the things that's kind of a bedrock reality in their lives is that the forces of nature are beyond our control. That's something only God controls. And you can see that theme in a lot of different places. One example of it that's good is Job. So let's turn to Job. 38. So if you remember the plot of Job, Job has all these terrible sufferings, and he starts to question why God would allow him to suffer when he's basically not done anything nearly as bad as most of the other people around him. And at the end of that, God shows up and basically tells Job all the things Job doesn't know and understand, and so it's probably not a good idea to question God. And if you recall, part of that setting is God answers him from a storm. And so the fact that God speaks from a storm is, even before God says anything, part of the evidence of, look, Job, you're dealing with things you don't know and understand that are beyond you. And in verse 8, God says, who shut up the sea behind doors when it bursts forth from the womb, when I made the clouds its garment and wrapped it in thick darkness, when I fixed limits for it and set its doors and bars in place, when I said, this far you may come and no farther, here is where your proud waves halt. So one of the running themes of the Old Testament is that the ocean and storms are bad things. They're out of our control, but they're in God's control. Okay? And so when we see things like the parting of the Red Sea, and then when it closes in on the Egyptians, that's sort of an ultimate demonstration of God is in control of nature in a way that even the most powerful human being isn't, right? And so for Jesus to demonstrate this kind of authority is shocking to them. This isn't the kind of authority that human beings have. And the way he does it is even more shocking. Even like when Moses is doing all these spectacular plagues, there's a huge emphasis in Moses on an appeal to the Lord to do these things. And afterwards, there's acknowledgement that, hey, the Lord did this. Like if you read the song of Miriam and Moses after they crossed the Red Sea, there's this huge emphasis on the Lord saved us, the Lord did this. And so for Jesus to be able to just rebuke the wind and the sea without having to go through any sort of elaborate appeal before he does it, suggests an ongoing delegation of authority for him to use as he thinks best. It's never happened before. And it's totally beyond anything even the disciples are expecting. And so what Jesus has just done has just blown away whatever box they've been trying to put him in thus far. And so, you know, they're on, it's like the carpet has been pulled out from beneath them, and they're in a place they don't understand anymore, right? The old Toto, we're not in Kansas anymore. And it's frightening. You know, what are we dealing with is the question they ask. But what we're going to see that I think is going to become a really important theme and in our application is that they don't understand Jesus yet, but they stick with him. As we're going to see in the next episode, the disciples are still with him. And so that, I think, is one of the critical things that separates the disciples from some of the other people we're going to see at the end of the day, is that even if you don't fully grasp who Jesus is, it's critical to understand what you've seen is good and he is worth sticking with him. And if you do that, you'll get more revelation and it will become clear to you who he is. And that's what you want. All right? Questions, comments so far? Yes. Yes. Yeah, no, that's a really good comment. So we are talking about different types of fear here. So, you know, the initial fear they have, I think, is we're about to die. And it's the kind of something really scary is happening that I'm afraid of, and I'm afraid of the consequences. And I think the fear that they have of Jesus later is the beginning of wisdom. And I think, because I think before this story, part of the problem the disciples have, and we're going to see that they kind of forget this fear as the gospel goes on, and they have to relearn it. Part of the problem people have is they think they know what Jesus is, and they're wrong. And I think that's true even of the disciples. They don't realize, they don't fully appreciate yet how big Jesus is, if I could put it that way. And so this was the beginning of wisdom. They're realizing our expectations were wrong. We don't know what the answer is yet, but we realize we were wrong, and that is the beginning of wisdom. That is, realizing you're wrong is the first step towards getting it right. And I think there's there is an element of reverence mixed in with that that is key to them taking the next step. So I think that's a good comment. This is a good fear in this instance. Yes.
Where would they jump from thinking they were going to die and instant calm? There had to be kind of an overwhelming conflict in their where am I at now?
Right. Right, no, the comment is this had to be a very unusual mixed emotions moment. I think that's very, very true. I mean, they must have felt like their mind was trying to run in opposite directions all at once, and it must have been very unsettling. And the whole experience must have been extremely emotional in the sense of producing very strong, different, and even conflicting emotions. So, life with Jesus, not boring. Yes.
If you look at what happened with him sleeping through this crisis, so it wakes him up, it's really wrong if he did.
Say the last sentence again, John.
Is it really wrong that they woke him up and said,
okay, so, yeah, the question is, was it wrong for them to wake him up? Let me back into that. So one of the really interesting things about this story is that it has a ton of parallels with the first chapter of Jonah. So if you remember the plot of Jonah, he gets in on a boat. He's going to Tarsus because he's running away from what God wants him to do. This crazy storm comes up. And what's Jonah doing? He's asleep, right? So the sailors wake him up and basically say the same thing. Don't you care that we're all about to drown? Why don't you pray to God or your God, right? Because they're not followers of Yahweh. And so this story follows that plot almost exactly, but yet it's 180 degrees different because instead of running away from what God wants, Jesus is doing exactly what God wants, and he's not asleep because he's ignoring God's will. He's asleep because he knows he's in God's will and everything's going to be okay. Okay? The disciples don't have that same level of understanding of what's going on. So I would say no, it's absolutely not wrong for them to wake Jesus up. It's absolutely a good thing when you're panicked and have a problem that seems overwhelming to you to go to Jesus with that problem. And so I don't think Jesus is rebuking them for coming to him and presenting the situation to him. What he's challenging is the fear and emotion that they had. So I think he's not trying to teach them, look, you should have been able to handle this yourselves. I think he's trying to teach them that as long as we're together and you're doing what I want, you don't have to worry about how things are going to turn out. And so I think this would have been a really powerful, in hindsight, like when we get to Acts, I think this episode would have been a really powerful moment for a teaching moment for the disciples, which is that if we're doing what Jesus has told us to do and the circumstances get really dire, such as Peter getting arrested, don't panic, because no matter how bad the circumstances look, Christ is in control. And that's the spiritual message that's being taught here. Here's the trick in applying it today. That's great if you're on the boat crossing the Sea of Galilee, just like Jesus told you. How do you know you're in that boat and not the one to Tarsus? And so, you know, when you're on the elder board and you're trying to figure out whether you should build an addition to the church and take on $3 million in debt, is that the boat to Tarsus or is that the boat crossing the Sea of Galilee? How do we know? And you know, you could translate that to a lot of different situations. Should I move to California to take this new job? Am I going to Tarsus or am I crossing the Sea of Galilee? Not always easy to tell. Sometimes it's really easy to tell. Does Jesus want me to share the gospel with that person? Probably yes. But that's the message. If you are doing what God wants, don't fear the circumstances. And, you know, I also think there's a lot of grace. You know, if you read the Psalms, God knows we have all these emotions and we aren't robots, and that when the disciples are trying to carry out his will, they're going to get terrified. The message is just to take that terror to him. Don't cope with it in unhealthy ways. Good question. Anything else? All right. Yes. Right. So, you know, the point I was trying to make there is that when we're in terrible circumstances, it's really easy to focus on the circumstances. And the trick is to see God in the midst of those circumstances. If you can do that, you're on your way to spiritual maturity. Yep. But not easy. And, you know, that's where hopefully as a body we can help each other. Now, that's why we need to be comfortable talking these things out and getting input from other people who are also trying to follow Christ, and hopefully we can help each other with that process. Now, you shouldn't be in this struggle alone. All right, let's move on to the next story. So they cross the Sea of Galilee, and that puts them in an area that's referred to different ways in this story. Sometimes the Gerasenes, which seem to be part of a larger region called the Decapolis, which basically means 10 cities. It's a province mostly to the east of the Sea of Galilee and very predominantly Gentile. So Galilee has Gentiles in it. The area of the Decapolis is going to have even a much, much higher percentage of Gentiles. Okay? So one of the emphases in this story is going to be the theme of uncleanness. And we're going to see a lot of things that from the Jewish perspective are unclean, starting with the fact that we're headed to an area that's filled with Gentiles who aren't bothering to keep kosher or do any of the other things a good first century Jew would be doing to stay ceremonially clean. So when Jesus got out of the boat, a man with an evil spirit — does anyone have something different there than an evil spirit? Unclean. So that's another — the NIV has gone with evil spirit, and by doing that, you kind of miss the theme of uncleanness. A lot of times, demons are referred to as unclean, and this is an example where Mark does that. So that's kind of our theme. So this guy's unclean, one, because he's possessed by a demon, which seems like a good rule, that if you're possessed by a demon, you're unclean. Came from the tombs. Dead bodies are unclean, so he's coming from an unclean place to meet him. And we're told this man lived in the tombs, so he lives in an unclean place, and no one could bind him anymore, not even with a chain, for he had often been chained hand and foot, but he tore the chains apart and broke the irons on his feet. No one was strong enough to subdue him. So not as impressive as a storm, but still beyond the ability of normal humans to control. So kind of one of the running themes of this group of miracles is we're encountering problems that are beyond the ability of normal humans to solve. First we had a storm, now we have a man possessed by demons who has as a result this supernatural strength that's made him impossible for normal humans to control. Night and day, among the tombs and in the hills, he would cry out and cut himself with stones. And so the really sad thing about his condition is that the demons have basically made him unable to relate to other people at all. He just lives out in the tombs. We're going to find out he doesn't wear any clothes. He cuts himself. He doesn't say anything coherent. He just screams. No one obviously wants to be anywhere near the guy. It's a pretty pathetic existence. When he saw Jesus from a distance, he ran and fell on his knees in front of him. He shouted at the top of his voice, "What do you want with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God?" Okay? We've seen this before from other people possessed by demons. The demons instantly recognize exactly who Jesus is. They understand Jesus is more powerful than them. And as soon as they encounter him, one, they acknowledge who he is. Two, they start pleading with him not to destroy them right away. Okay? So that's kind of what's going on here. "Swear to God that you won't torture me." For Jesus had said to him, "Come out of this man, you unclean or evil spirit." So the demon's worried about what Jesus is going to do with him. It's trying to negotiate with Jesus. Then Jesus does something unusual. Jesus asked him, "What is your name?" "My name is Legion," he replied, "for we are many." So here we find out this guy isn't possessed by just one demon. It's a whole bunch of them, although we don't know how many yet. And he begged Jesus again and again not to send them out of the area. A large herd of pigs are unclean, remember, was feeding on the nearby hillside. So here we learn, you know, this is really an unclean area. We've got a bunch of pork-eating Gentiles in the area, right? Send us among the pigs, allow us to go into them. He gave them permission, and the evil spirits came out and went into the pigs. The herd, about 2,000 in number, rushed down the steep bank into the lake and were drowned. So that's a lot of pigs. And so that tells us there were a whole lot of demons involved. Those tending the pigs ran off and reported this in the town and countryside, and the people went out to see what had happened. When they came to Jesus, they saw the man who'd been possessed by the legion of demons sitting there, dressed and in his right mind, and they were afraid. It's a very similar reaction to the one the disciples just had. They just realized Jesus has solved this problem utterly beyond their ability to solve, and it happened in a pretty dramatic way, and their reaction is to be afraid. We've just encountered something we don't understand. It's more powerful than us. You know, does it mean us good? Does it mean us ill? What does this mean? And they're scared. Those who had seen it told the people what had happened to the demon-possessed man and told about the pigs as well. Then the people began to plead with Jesus to leave their region. So their reaction is they don't want to know more about Jesus. So unlike the disciples, their reaction to the fear is not to stick with Jesus and to find out more, but to say, this is scary, I don't want to know any more about it. Okay? As Jesus was getting into the boat, the man who had been demon-possessed begged to go with him. So the man who's had the demon cast out of him, however, wants to stick with Jesus. So that's good. But, surprisingly, Jesus did not let him, but said, "Go home to your family and tell them how much the Lord has done for you and how he has had mercy on you." So now this is really different, right? So far, whenever this kind of thing happens in the Gospel of Mark, Jesus has been saying, don't tell. So why is this different? You know, why does Jesus tell this guy not to stay with him and instead go back home? And why does he tell him not to be quiet, but to tell everyone? As often happens in Mark, Mark doesn't tell us. We have to guess. Don't know for sure. One possibility that seems to make sense is it, remember, they're in a Gentile area, and so the people he's going to be talking to aren't going to have messianic expectations. And so if this guy goes back and starts telling his family what happened to him and what the Lord did for him, it's not going to mess up Jesus' management of the presentation of himself as Messiah to the nation of Israel. So that may be why it's okay in Jesus' mind for this guy to talk about what's going on and the miracle that Jesus did. That's not going to mess up Jesus' confrontation with the leaders of Israel. So this is kind of the first commission of someone to go out and be a missionary for Jesus. And it's interesting that it's a guy who's just been possessed by a demon, who's a Gentile and lives in a Gentile area. But that's what happens, according to Mark. So the man went away, and interestingly, he does what Jesus tells him to do. You know, what we've seen in the past is people tend to ignore Jesus' advice in these situations, and began to tell in the Decapolis how much Jesus had done for him, and all the people were amazed. So Mark doesn't follow up and tell us how many of those people moved from amazement to actually being followers of Jesus. But we see that this man is the first missionary commissioned by Jesus, and that he does what he's supposed to. Yes? Right.
Right.
No, I don't think so. I mean, I guess it distinguishes it from an angel. I mean, the question is unclean strong enough to describe a demon? And I don't know. You know, you've got the combination of unclean and spirit. So that kind of tells you you're talking about a demon. So maybe it's the combination of those two words that carries the concept. But for whatever reason, in this case, and you know, the question you're raising is probably why the NIV translators went the next step and said evil spirit, right? Because evil's a stronger word to us than unclean. The problem that you lose with that is that when you go that route, it makes it hard for the English reader to see the theme of uncleanness, ceremonially uncleanness running through the story. And so this is the problem translators often encounter, is that words often carry multiple aspects, and it's hard to come up with a word that would communicate both that Mark is emphasizing unclean and also seems strong enough to tell us this is also an evil spirit. And so you find translators choosing between evil or unclean. You know, I guess they could go and expand it even more and say an evil unclean spirit. But this is the dilemma of translating things. And a lot of times you have to choose. And this is why it helps to compare different translations and study a passage to make sure you're capturing everything that Mark was trying to tell. I mean, his translation's not a perfect enterprise. Sometimes you just do the best you can. That probably doesn't answer your question, but I'm not sure I can answer it. Yeah.
Interesting that Jesus calls himself just Lord. Is that because of the Gentile thing too? But he doesn't call himself, you know, capital Lord Yahweh.
Right.
It would mean nothing.
So,
maybe, I don't know
the thing that you're... So the question is about the Lord. And one of the interesting things about the end of this passage is that Jesus says, go home and tell them how much the Lord has done for you. So that would be what we would typically think of as God the Father, what a first century Jew would think of as Yahweh. So he doesn't just mean Lord in the sense of, you know, English, my Lord, you know, take me to the manor. He means the Lord, okay? And then the man goes away and talks about what Jesus has done for him. And so I think one of the interesting things in this passage is that Jesus is at a minimum claiming that what he does is the Lord's work. And so there's a big spiritual claim here that I am the Lord's representative doing the Lord's work. And so when you talk about what I did for you, you are talking about what the Lord did. And the man gets it because he says, go home and tell them how much the Lord has done for you. And he goes home and tells them what Jesus did for him. So one of the little subtle things in this story that your comment brings out, and it's good not to miss, is that Jesus is tying himself and what he does to the Lord really closely. So it's another big claim of spiritual authority. I'm the guy right now who speaks and acts for the Lord, not the guys in Jerusalem with the fancy robes. Okay? Yes?
Why the pigs in the other story where he casts a beam and he just drives them out in this case?
Yep. So why does Jesus negotiate with these spirits and allow them to go into the pigs? Mark doesn't tell us. And, you know, this, when you read the commentaries, this troubles some people. I don't know how many of you have a pet pig, but, you know, some of the people are like, what are the ethical implications of letting the demons go into the pigs, right? You know, and then the pigs die. And then there are a few people who are like businessmen, and they're like, well, that's a lot of money. Who paid for those pigs? You know, And Mark has no interest in helping us with any of those questions. And so we really have to speculate, and I'm not sure what the explanation is. You know, the one thing I can say, I think I'm on safe ground, is this is bad news for people who think pigs have souls, because I think if pigs had souls, Jesus wouldn't have done this. I don't think Jesus would have allowed it to happen. But it is interesting, and I don't quite know what to do with it, to be honest. Because Mark doesn't tell us, yes. Yeah, you know, so the question is, what are the demons afraid of? And part of the difficulty in answering that is that most of the time, Jesus cuts off the conversation. There are a few times where one of the demons will say something like, "Have you come to judge us or do something to us before the appointed time?" And it suggests to me that the demons are aware of their ultimate fate, which if you go to Revelation, is they're going to get chunked in the everlasting lake of fire. And so it's almost like they're afraid Jesus is going to do that to them now. And one of the things the commentators say, that like a lot of the times the remark they first make to Jesus could be translated along the lines of, "Why are you bothering me now? I'm not really bothering you." It's a really hard phrase to translate, because it's one of those colloquial phrases that if you just translated it literally would go something like, "What is it between you and me?" And it's kind of a way of saying, "I'm not messing with you. Why are you messing with me now?" And the implication seems to be a timing thing, that they know someday Jesus is going to judge them and throw them into eternal torment, but they weren't expecting it to happen so soon, and they're scared that he's decided to fast-track the process with them. I'll come to you back first. Yeah, so the question is, what happened to the demons? Really good question. I mean, it'd be fascinating if the pigs were smart enough to know that, like, somehow they were going to blot the demon out of existence. You know, then we'd be like, yay, pigs. And, you know, I've heard some preachers go, you know, with the idea, this shows pigs have better instincts than humans, because when they were possessed, they drowned themselves, you know. I've heard that actually preached. I don't know. And it's a great, great question. But it's unanswerable. No one tries to answer it. Yes. Okay, see? That's why you ask questions. If you're thinking it, someone else is too. Yes. Yeah, so the question is, what were the demons thinking? Were they surprised by what the pigs did? Again, we don't know. The first thing they say is, "Don't send us out of the region." So maybe they liked hanging around the tombs in this unclean place. Maybe that felt like a good place for demons. I don't know what demons like. But we don't know. You know, did the pigs pull a fast one on them? Did Jesus make the pigs do that? We don't know these things. They did. That's very possible. But Mark doesn't tell us, so we don't know for sure. But that is certainly a possibility. Yep. Good question. Anything else? All right, let's push through one more story. All right, so we've got control over the storm, control over the legion of demons, And then we get the most difficult problem of all for humanity in the next story. When Jesus had again crossed over by boat to the other side of the lake, so we're back in Galilee, a large crowd gathered around him while he was by the lake. We've seen that before. Then one of the synagogue rulers, named Jairus, came there. Seeing Jesus, he fell at his feet and pleaded earnestly with him, "My little daughter is dying. Please come and put your hands on her so that she will be healed and live." So Jesus went with him. So a synagogue ruler would have been a lay person, would have been in charge of maintaining the synagogue building, probably also had responsibilities like making sure Sabbath worship services took place, deciding which scriptures were going to be read, who would read them, okay? And so you can imagine the scene. There's this huge crowd listening to Jesus teach. This guy interrupts, and the fact that he interrupts shows that he understands this to be a really urgent situation. And so this is really brave of him, because if you remember, the authorities in Jerusalem have kind of put the word out already that Jesus is a bad guy teaching bad things. He's empowered by unclean spirits. We don't like what he's doing. And he's doing this in front of a crowd. So he is showing in public that he is willing to appeal for Jesus. He's also showing great faith in Jesus by saying, "Hey, I think my daughter's dying, but I think you can save her." So he's like the disciples. He understands he has a problem he can't solve, and then he needs to go to Jesus with it. But notice the limitations he's put on Jesus. This is an urgent request, because if I need you to get to her before she dies. So he believes Jesus can heal the sick, doesn't think he can raise the dead. Okay? Hold that thought. So Jesus went with him. A large crowd followed. And as you can imagine, they're like, "Hey, this is even more interesting than the sermon. Let's see how this plays out." And pressed around him. And a woman was there who had been subject to bleeding for 12 years. She had suffered a great deal under the care of many doctors and had spent all she had, yet instead of getting better, she grew worse. So this is a classic Mark story sandwich. And so the synagogue ruler and his little girl is the slice of bread. This is the meat. And here we meet a woman who has an incurable disease. So there's some diseases you can go to a doctor and they can help solve. This is one that's been beyond the control of anyone to help her. So for 12 years, she's been suffering, getting worse. She's spent all her money on it, beyond her ability to control. And like Jairus, she believes Jesus can help her. And she doesn't want to trouble Jesus and actually verbally ask him to help her. She thinks, if I can just touch his clothes, that'll be enough. And so it's very touching, you know, shows great faith in Jesus, probably also shows a little bit of shame and fear. She probably not only has great faith in Jesus, she probably also doesn't want to, in the midst of this great crowd, say, "Hey, everybody, I've got this bleeding problem that no one can solve, and so please, Jesus, help me with it," right? And part of the reason for that is this would have made her constantly unclean in Jewish society. So if you're a woman and you're bleeding, you're unclean under the Levitical code. So another, you know, one of the running themes in the Gospel of Mark is that Jesus isn't afraid of unclean things. He's not afraid to go to the Decapolis in the midst of a tomb and encounter a demon-possessed guy, because he makes unclean things clean. He's different than you and me. Okay? So she touches him. Immediately her bleeding stopped, and she felt in her body that she was freed from her suffering. At once, Jesus realized power had gone out from him. He turned around in the crowd and asked, "Who touched my clothes?" And so one of the themes of this story is people kind of laughing at Jesus and thinking he's being ridiculous. And in this case, it's the disciples. "You see the people crowding against you," his disciples answered, "and yet you can ask, 'Who touched me?'" And their point is, everybody's touching you, Jesus. You know, you're being jostled constantly. What do you mean, who touched me? And I think Jesus knows exactly who touched him. So this question is really a challenge slash invitation to the woman. Are you willing to make this public? Okay? And we're told he kept looking around. But Jesus kept looking around to see who had done it. Then the woman, knowing what had happened to her, came and fell at his feet and trembling with fear, so fear has kind of been a running theme today, told him the whole truth. So she has the faith to take the next step, which is to make public what her problem was and acknowledge the fact that Jesus just healed her from it. Jesus said to her, "Daughter, your faith has healed you. Go in peace and be freed from your suffering." Okay? So Jesus says, faith in me has allowed you to experience relief from this problem you couldn't solve. While Jesus was still speaking, some men came from the house of Jairus, the synagogue ruler. "Your daughter is dead," they said. "Why bother the teacher anymore?" So not the most sensitive guys. We're told some translations will say, like, assistants with the synagogue. So it's people who know this Jairus. They may also be involved in the synagogue. And they're like, oh, they also have the same view as Jairus, which is that if Jesus doesn't get there before she dies, there's nothing Jesus can do. And they helpfully tell him, stop bothering the guy. Let him go about his day. Okay. Ignoring what they said, Jesus told the synagogue ruler, "Don't be afraid, just believe." So Jesus, this is what we call a big ask. Jesus tells a guy, don't be troubled by this news that your daughter has just died. Just have faith in me. So this may be the biggest ask we've seen yet. And Jairus goes along. We're told he did not let anyone follow him except Peter, James, and John, the brother of James. So Jesus calls off the crowd, and only three people from the disciples in the crowd go with him. And we're going to find out Jairus is with him too. When they came to the home of the synagogue ruler, Jesus saw a commotion with people crying and wailing loudly. And we think these people may be professional mourners. So one of the things that's different about their society than ours is that when there's a death in the house, you would actually pay people to come up, show up outside your house, cry, wail, display other signs of mourning. Everyone passing by would know there'd been a death in the house. Part of the reason we think they may have been that way is that when Jesus passes by and says, why all this commotion and wailing? The child is not dead, but asleep. They laughed at him. If they'd been more emotionally invested in this family, they probably wouldn't laugh, right? So this little detail tells us a couple of things. This little girl is so dead that the family has already arranged to have professional mourners show up, and they've shown up, okay? And I think the point Mark's making is that she ain't just in a coma. She ain't really just sleeping. She's dead, okay? Why then does Jesus say she's just sleeping? Mark doesn't explain. So this one's tricky. Real quickly, there are two possible explanations. One is, for whatever reason, Jesus seems to be, this is one of those instances where he doesn't want the full story to get out right away. He's going to tell the family not to tell people about it. But number two, one of the things the New Testament emphasizes is that death is not the end. And so it will often talk about death as sleep to remind us that everybody gets resurrected someday. Could be one, the other, don't know. After he put them all out, he took the child's father and mother and the disciples who were with them, went in where the child was, took her by the hand, and says, Talitha cum, which is Aramaic, which means, little girl, I say to you, get up. Immediately the girl stood up and walked around. She was 12 years old, the exact same number of years the woman has been bleeding. So I think that's why Mark gives us that detail to tie the two stories together. Immediately the girl stood up, walked around. At this they were completely astonished. He gave strict orders not to let anyone know about this and told them to give her something to eat. So Jesus rewards Jairus' faith by showing he can do even more than Jairus expected, which is he can solve the biggest problem humanity faces, which is death. And so the running theme throughout these miracles is Jesus is even bigger than anyone expected. He has control not over nature, over demons, over disease, and even death. And so that actually makes the problem of the disciples have, which is who is this guy, even worse, because there's no Old Testament category that they were expecting to have this kind of authority, not even the Messiah. So in a way, this set of stories makes the dilemma about Jesus even worse. But what this story also shows us is, remember 2 weeks ago, we studied the parables, and one of the principles that was taught was that to the one who has some interest in Jesus, more will be given. To the one who has little interest, whatever they've heard about Jesus fades away, and they end up with no revelation at all. And so what we see here is, even if you don't understand Jesus completely, even if you don't understand everything that he can do for you, if you go to him with your problem, he can do even more than you expect. You will learn more about Jesus, and the people who stick with Jesus are the ones that their relationship grows. Okay? And so that's kind of the application for us. As difficult as it is to understand what God is doing in our lives, if we stick with him, more will be given to you. If you decide God is no interest to you, then your heart will be hardened and you'll lose what you even have. So the message is stick with Jesus. And I've gone over time. So we'll come back and clean some of this up next week too. Thanks, guys.